Rise up, emus. Rise up.
Hello, Michelle. Michelle, there you are in front of me. How are you?
I'm good. I was about to start singing because I thought you were bursting into song, but maybe not. Maybe not. I'm great.
Not
I'm
today.
Always great.
Well, what's with the great?
I know. It's getting boring, isn't it?
Why are you always just so great? You're one note. You're one note, Michelle. One note, that's great.
Yeah, do you know what? Nobody wants to hear, oh my God, my life's so terrible. I did this, I did that. Oh, it's awful. I've got my ops.
That's what Facebook's for, isn't it? To whinge and complain. I often wonder about that. What compels people to put a post on Facebook that is something like...
miserable?
Well, no, just bitching about their family or friends or saying, why do people have to blah, 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 and so. It's kind of passive aggressive, isn't it? What do they want to achieve from that? Wouldn't it be easier to pick up the phone and have a chat with the person themselves, I wonder?
Too confrontational. People prefer the passive aggressive.
You prefer, did you say? I prefer passive aggressive, says Michelle.
People. But look.
Love a passive aggressive.
I'm really anti the passive aggressive. It's not for me.
It's hard to respond to, isn't it?
It is, unless you say, stop with that passive-aggressive shit, and then they get very upset.
What would you say if somebody said that?
I've said in the past.
How did that go down?
I've said it to someone, and they're like, what are you talking about? I don't even know what that means. And I'm like, oh.
That was the end of the conversation, was it?
No, you have to explain, and then you just, I don't know. But anyway, aside from all of that, Geordie,
yes,
we should introduce ourselves. Oh.
Well, I'm Geordie.
And I'm Michelle, and you are listening to Eavesdropping the Podcast.
Poor you. I feel for you. I feel for you. No, really, I think people do enjoy to listen to this podcast, actually, Michelle. We've had some lovely comments. People have been sending in voice notes. We had one from Shari, who's a great listener. She'd sent in some really good episode ideas in the past. A lot of the good murders have come from her.
Yes.
She actually sent a voice note empathizing with our feelings for shit reality TV and how you get sucked in. Essentially, she's talking about maths. She did say that this would be the last time she watches it because she's lost a lot of her life, basically.
Hours.
A bit like you and me. And also Janneke in Amsterdam. She is right up in there with the maths. But everybody loves Lucinda. Lucinda needs her own show.
Look, I will say to Shari, sweetheart, I've been in your position.
Sweetheart.
I have said no more. No more maths. That's She's the done. Last time. And guess what? I get reeled right in every time.
She said this is the last time she's going to watch it. So let's see about that. Especially if we start talking about it and she's still listening to us.
Well, speaking of us, I would like to say, we never normally say stuff like this, but I would like to say for anybody who maybe hasn't listened to Eavesdropping before, maybe this is your first time Eavesdropping.
Welcome.
But I also want to say we are a comedy, real life, true crime, supernatural podcast.
Don't you forget
There's going to be some laughs along the way, but we do talk about serious stuff. We do make fun of it, but everyone's respectful. We try to be respectful.
Why are you saying this? Has somebody had a word to you?
Well, people have said that we do treat the serious subjects very respectfully, and I think we do try to be respectful, but we also do throw the laughs in, and I think that's not for everyone.
Oh, who's had a word to you, Michelle? Has somebody ripped you to pieces?
It could be someone. I'm not going to name names, but it could be someone. So I just want to say we do try to have fun here. Don't get your tits in a tangle. All right? We are a true crime comedy podcast. Supernatural, real life.
Well, we do have to be sensitive because you're right, Michelle. Some of the content, and I've got some content today that might blow your socks off, it can be sensitive. And that's the nature of true crime. It's out there for people to read about and get appalled about. And we're not laughing at people, for sure. But we do like to inject a few laughs.
Well, you know, as Jen said.
What'd she say?
When she went to a funeral.
Oh, if you don't laugh, you cry.
I said, how's the funeral, Mom? You were right. She's like, oh, well, there was no laughs. And you know what? You do have to have a few laughs, even in the darkest moments. So that's what we do here.
Where's Jen's podcast?
Well, do you know what? Might be interviewing Jen soon. Oh, we'll yes, see, please. Hey?
Yes.
Might have to put that on the Patreon.
Yes, for the extra droppings. Now, recently, by the way, Extra Droppings is out for April. Those of you who are paid patrons, thank you. You get a treat. Tell us what it is, Michelle.
We are talking to number one best-selling author, Zoe Folbig. She wrote The Note. She met a guy on the train, ended up being her husband. This month on Patreon, we talked to her about her inspiration, some true crime, some real life.
It's so interesting.
Some supernatural. Have a listen. We'd love to hear what you think of Zoe's interview.
And Michelle's conversation, actually, because they're old friends. It's lovely to hear you two chitty-chatting. It's also really interesting to hear Zoe's journey from working on the desk at She magazine to
yes,
being a top-selling, best-selling author, and how even best-selling authors get rejected and rejected and rejected.
Yep, that's right. And sometimes, you know, if you really believe in yourself, you just got to keep going. Yeah. And it will happen. Anyone who doesn't know Zoe, you can look her up. I'll link it up on the Patreon, and check her book out, The Note. It's a real heartwarming love story.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And it's real.
Extra, extra, read all about
Give
it.
Give me the scoop.
He's dropping wind and there's no doubt about it.
He's dropping.
Please go over to Patreon and be a patron if you can. Supporting us is a little thing you can do, but it's massive to us. I mean, I love the fact that everybody's writing in, voice noting. We've had a lot of info from friends and family of the podcast. When I say friends and family, I mean you guys, just you listeners. And there are people who we don't mention week after week because they're not getting in touch. And if you feel that you're missing out on getting a mention, then write in or voice note us at hello@eavesdroppin.com. Thank you. Michelle always knows it better than me. Michelle, as you know, I was in Australia recently. I just arrived back and I was curled up in a ball on that fucking 24-hour long flight. I needed a massage, and my husband, as you know, is an osteopath, so he got to work on me, so to speak.
Yes. Dirty old lady.
He picked up something in Australia called emu oil and he put it on me. He told me what it was and I said, oh, what's in that? Because I could smell the eucalyptus. He said, oil of emu. And I was like, what? No, it does. No, it's not. And then he said, yep. And I thought he was joking for ages, right? Eventually, he picked up the jar, read out the ingredients, and lo and behold, Michelle, there is oil of emu in fucking emu oil, right? So I was horrified. I just thought it was like eucalyptus, manuka, urine, or whatever, and it would spell emu, E-M-U. Actually, it's got bird oil in it.
Right.
It's got bird oil in it. And guess who uses it on their face? Cate Blanchett. Kate Blanchett, of course she does. She uses like baby penises. Do you remember we talked about it? That
yes,
baby penis cream.
Did.
She's got that on her fucking face. She puts everything on her face, that lady. She doesn't give a shit. If it's dead, she'll put it on her face. But I'll tell you where this emu oil comes from.
Where?
From the thick back fat of the emu, because I Googled it afterwards. And I think two things here, Michelle. Number one, leave the fucking emus alone. And number two, get that back fat oil off of my body immediately. You know, the emu has to be killed to extract the oil.
Yes.
And they're not used for any other. They are not useful. That you can't eat the meat. Who realized that you can use emu oil and it's good for arthritis or whatever, or for Cate Blanchett's fucking face?
I knew about emu oil from maybe 10 years ago when I was on the beauty desk, got slipped this emu oil, and I'm all up for like, oh, what's this great new thing? Oh, it's a la natural emu oil. Then I also did the research and was mortified. The emu has to fucking die for that oil. Do not put that on your face. Cate Blanchett, I know you're a listener.
Kate, come on now, love.
Kate, stop putting that shit
stop
on your
putting
face.
The oil of dead things on your face. It's on the crest.
It's not nice.
It's on the Australian crest. That's like us here in England using swan oil for something. Surely.
You can't do it.
I feel a petition coming on, Michelle. I feel a petition coming
me
on.
Me too. Yep. I'll sign it.
Well, let me tell you some good things about emus, right? Did you hear about how the emus fought an army and won?
No, I did not. That sounds like bullshit.
No, it's in the Australian news or in Wikipedia. Somebody in Australia told me while I was there. It's known as the Emu right. War. It was a military operation that was launched to cull emus in Western Australia that were destroying crops in 1932. And they planned to kill 20,000 of them using machine guns. Gross.
Oh, fucking hell.
But the emus rose up and fought back, and they only killed about 1,000. So perhaps they ought to
emu
rise
uprising.
Up. Yeah, maybe they should start uprising against the emu oil manufacturers and bloody Cate Blanchett.
Rise up, emus, rise up. Well, do you know what? As you know, I'm currently in Australia.
We missed each other, didn't we?
We did miss each other. I did that journey. I too needed a bloody massage. So when I had my 3-hour stopover in Bangkok, I went and found the Thai ladies who I got a 45-minute massage. Ooh. Boom, head, neck and shoulders.
Oh, wow.
I was on heaven. I mean, it was all fucked by the time I did the last leg, yep. But it was wonderful.
It's a game changer.
Absolutely loved it. Yeah. I love a Thai massage.
Well done. So, Michelle, this week's episode is a true crime. That's correct, isn't it?
It is true crime, and I've got a doozy.
Well, before you give me your doozy, I'm going to tell you a little something that I learned recently through my 13-year-old daughter, and it begins in a very dark place. So, listeners, trigger warning, there is murders and there is damage and there is some horror I'm about to tell you. And we're not laughing at it or with it. I'm just going to tell you. Those of us who live in the UK may remember that in January this year, 2024, on the evening of the 31st, the horrific news came from the southwest London suburb of Clapham, which is where I travel through every day, of a woman and her two kids being attacked by a man in the street with a corrosive alkaline substance after assaulting the children and attempting to run them over. The man ran and he was chased by passers-by as other witnesses ran to the woman and the children's aid. Did you remember hearing about that? The alkaline attack in Clapham?
Yes, but I think I erased it.
Okay. Well, the people who ran to the woman and children's aid, including a resident who rescued the child while the mother was under attack by the substance, suffered burns to their face and arms. This substance basically spread from person to person to person.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. The victim and her youngest child sadly had life-changing injuries, and nine people who went to help her and the kids, including police officers who arrived on the scene, were also taken to hospital with burns. The reason why I'm telling you this will become apparent. The perpetrator was a man called Abdul Azedi, originally from Afghanistan, who had a traumatic history before arriving via lorry in the UK in 2016. And he was arrested previously for sexual assault and indecent exposure. He was on the sex offenders list. This is just background, by the way. I'm not talking about this so much today, so forgive me. But it's said that he was in a relationship with the woman and that turned sour and he was not the father of the children. That's just a little background because no one really knows much more than this, except there was a manhunt on for Azedi and the police were tracking him by CCTV heading to King's Cross and then back towards central London. He was on the run, basically, and there were photos of him all over the news. And you could see that he was also significantly injured on the right side of his face by the alkaline substance. It looked like his eye was missing and half of his face. So police had informed the public not to approach him. You would recognize him if you saw him. And the last sighting of Azedi was pacing and leaning over the railings of Chelsea Bridge later that night. The search continued into February. And it wasn't until February the 9th that they searched the Thames for Azedi. And during this search, police pulled out the bodies of two men from the river, with both deaths being treated by police as unexpected, pending further inquiries. They weren't the guy they were looking for, but they found two other bodies.
Fuck, man. So people are just getting murdered and being tossed into the Thames.
Well, I don't know about that. This is what I'm talking about today. We don't know if they're being murdered and tossed into the Thames. But if Azedi was eventually discovered 10 days later in the Thames, having drowned, but shockingly, there was yet another body discovered on the 22nd of February. This one was found near Putney Pier, didn't match any missing persons reports. And that's because 19-year-old Samaria Ayanli who was a university student, had not been reported missing until 3 weeks later on March the 8th, which is shocking in itself.
What is going on here? I'm intrigued.
It's so intriguing. My TikTok-loving daughter told me about a serial killer in London who is targeting black girls and said that the police weren't doing anything about it. So I thought, okay, well, that's pretty inflammatory and wild.
Yeah.
What's this? You know.
The real story.
Yeah. What's the real story? So I took to TikTok to try and make sense of it. And I had dismissed it as being false to begin with. Because, you know, when we did this before, I discovered the whole story about the Hampstead hoax, right?
Yes.
And it was a big story to unravel. So my first stop on TikTok was Mary the Medium. Now, she had a lot to say about this, and she might be the person who's propelling the whole thing. She says spirits have told her that there is a serial killer in London currently operating, and he's after anyone who dresses provocatively or autistic people. And she has an X page, formerly Twitter, as they keep calling it, X formerly Twitter, that says, there is a serial killer on the River Thames. By day, a man, at night, a woman in distress. I'm standing with the families Conti, Johnson, Lewis, and others to get justice for the missing. Please join me on April 20, noon, at London Bridge. That's today.
That's today.
Yeah. We're recording this a little bit ahead of time. And by the time you hear this, it'll be a couple of weeks later. So maybe we can do an update next episode. It's a march for action. Who knows if anyone will be joining her? That will be interesting to find out.
Okay.
On TikTok, she says that he's a Rwandan priest who committed genocide and apparently killed 2,000 people during the Rwandan genocide and spent 12 years in jail. She says he targets people who have deficits and is performing a biblical cleansing along the River Thames. And if you want to hear more about that, she's got a podcast called Psychic Investigations into the Missing. There you have it.
I'll link that up.
So the names that she quoted were allegedly suspicious deaths in the Thames that some feel the police aren't doing enough about. So I went backwards using those names and I discovered, first of all, Damien Lewis, not the ginger actor who's going out with Alison Moss Hart, not him.
Cat bum mouth.
Cat bum mouth? What?
Damien Lewis has a little mouth like a cat's bum. I'm not the one who made that up. I'm just repeating. Oh. He has been called cat's bum mouth.
Oh, poor guy. He's very handsome for an older man. I met him recently backstage at a Kills gig. Because he's going out with that lady.
Alison. Yeah. Look, I think he's quite an attractive ranger. Oh, for sure.
Can't say that.
Cat's bum mouth ranger.
Oh, but he's attractive. You've really painted a very attractive picture.
He is. He's got a little something something.
Okay. So Damien, no more laughing. This is Damien Lewis, who is a vulnerable and severely autistic young man living in a care facility. And he was found in the Thames near Westminster Pier in September 2023 with a rope tied around each wrist and a dumbbell attached to the rope weighing 2 kilograms each. Now, that is horrifying, but it's not enough to sink this 6-foot-tall man. It's highly bizarre and suspicious, though. And the circumstances, I mean, there's a lot with Damien Lewis's story, but the circumstances surrounding him going missing from his care facility, 13 miles from where he was found, had his family baffled. And he lay in the morgue unidentified for 3 weeks.
Oh.
Again, due to confusion over where he was staying and the massive gap in the duty of care at the facility. And I'm not blaming them, but there is some confusion over, you know, the reports that I read were very tenuous.
Mm.
Like he would come and go from this facility. He was highly vulnerable, yet somehow he was able to leave the facility and his family weren't told. And 3 weeks later, he was then reported missing. And of course, then he was found in the Thames. Then there's 21-year-old Paul Conti, who went missing and was found a few days later in the Thames in August 2021. Paul was from Putney and he didn't return home one night after a party at the house of one of his kickboxing clients in Barnes, a very affluent part of London, in August 15th of that year. Like Damien Lewis's family, Paul's mum is convinced he was murdered and said that the police investigation into her son's death wasn't thorough enough to start with. And she thinks that some of the lines of inquiry weren't followed up. She claims police often dismissed her and told her things like, I can't answer that, or I didn't look into that. So now she's calling for the case to be reopened. And some of the mysterious claims around that case include one of his friends receiving a message while they were searching for Paul. A man sent his friend a message claiming that he saw Paul get stabbed and put into a car. But there is no CCTV proving this, and police say that Paul's death was not suspicious. Then, 2019, in Dagenham, 17-year-old Kane Johnson went missing, and after 5 days, it was reported to police. And a frantic 11-day search to find him began. And again, in circumstances eerily similar to Damian Lewis, Kane was discovered on April 21st of 2019, floating in the Thames near Lambeth Bridge, again 13 miles from his home. Kane was considered high risk and had removed his SIM card and shut down all his social media accounts before going missing. Kane showed signs of suicidal ideation, but it wasn't known by his family or friends.
Okay.
And when he left home before going missing, he told his sister he loved her. So it may be that that was a case of Kane wanting to take his own life. Toxicology reports showed that he had ingested large amounts of codeine and other painkillers. However, when they found Kane, his lungs were not filled with water, which would normally indicate the victim had drowned. But a doctor at his inquest said that people can die after going into cardiac arrest when falling into cold water. So perhaps he had a heart attack instead of drowning.
I understand that feeling because that happened to me. I was at the school sports day, Kayleen High, and jumped into cold water at Dixon Pool in winter. Yeah. I literally thought I was going to die. I felt like my heart was going to stop.
They say it takes your breath away.
Yep. I couldn't breathe. And I really panicked. It's the most horrible feeling. Probably why I have a fear of swimming now.
Do you?
You know me. We go to, when we went to France and we were in those beautiful rivers and I'm like, no, I'm not getting in.
You didn't get in?
No. I have a real kind of fear of things and I don't like cold water.
So back to my story. Additionally, there have been reports of black women whose bodies have been found in or near bodies of water recently, going back to my daughter's outlandish claim that there is a serial killer targeting black women. I looked into that as well. Most of the deaths have been ruled as non-suspicious, which TikTok users have added to their list of suspicious deaths. Oh. And I wonder if that's because it just hasn't been looked into enough to satisfy public opinion.
Maybe.
The names of the deceased were posted on an X account belonging to Black Women UK, and the names were Blessing Olusegun, Richard Okoregai, I'm sorry if I'm getting this wrong, Olisa Odokowe, Kion Williams, Tayo Balogun, and Samaria Ayanle. I know that I have absolutely butchered those names and I'm sorry. They had all been found near bodies of water, and some of those are boys. Two of those names I've said are boys, okay? They had been found near bodies of water and the authorities have not investigated most of these cases as unusual, which has, like I said, prompted people online to question if there is a serial killer in London targeting black women. And I think that's a different strand to the one that Mary the Medium is going along.
Yes. And also, too, you said there are two dudes in that lineup.
There are two dudes in that. And the previous list that Mary the Medium had discussed were young, vulnerable men. Not one of them were women.
Okay.
Although she has included Samaria in her list for some reason, I think. But let's go back to Blessing Olusegun. In September 2020, 21-year-old Blessing was found on Bexhill seafront, nowhere near the Thames, down in East Sussex. The cause of death was said to be drowning, and it was reported that she couldn't swim, but her mother said she would not have gone into the sea intentionally. And her family have campaigned for further investigation into the death, but police say there's no evidence of a crime. She, too, had been missing for some time before a passerby found her. Blessing had been in Bexhill on a one-week placement as a carer and was last seen by CCTV footage at around 1 a.m. walking towards the beach alone. So again, I guess the police have come to the conclusion.
Was she meeting someone?
I don't know if she was meeting someone. There's no more information, just none. And it's dropped. Yeah. Then Richard Okoregai, who was 19, was found in a pond in Epping Forest in Essex on the 5th of April 2021, 2 weeks after he went missing from his home in West London. Richard had sickle cell anemia. He left home on the 22nd of March that year without his medication. And the next day, his mum contacted the police, but her son was only officially recorded as a missing person the following day. Richard's cause of death was given as consistent with drowning by forensic pathologists at an inquest. and an investigation by the police watchdog, the IOPC, Independent Office for Police Conduct, found that Richard should have been classed as a missing person much sooner, and he was classed as low risk for too long.
Right.
So there was a ball dropped there.
There was a ball
dropped.
Essentially, he's a missing person, maybe a victim of misadventure rather than foul play.
It does sound like it, though. He had travelled from West London to Epping Forest. Who, what, where, how, why? You know, this investigation found that the Met Police provided an unacceptable level of service to Richard's mother after she reported her son missing. Olisa Odokwe was 20 when police divers found his body in Bristol Harbour in May 2021. He was a second-year Bristol University student and was last seen leaving his home on Saturday the 1st of May that morning, and his girlfriend and friends searched for days for him to no avail. Not much more is known about this, but it's unlikely to be a serial killer. It's not the right area. I think it was another misadventure situation. But the main concern here for me is just how long it took in each of these cases for the person to go missing and their body to be found.
Officially, yes. Look, I tend to maybe agree with you here that it doesn't sound like serial killer. It sounds like TikTok is connecting dots where there's none to be connected, and the investigations were treated poorly. The families were treated poorly. It's about dropping balls rather than a serial killer.
Well, definitely dropping balls. And according to research into ethnicities of missing people by the Missing People Charity, it does say that people from minority ethnic groups were missing for longer, less likely to be found by police, and less likely to be recorded at being at risk than white people, which is unacceptable.
Oh, shit.
But back to the Thames situation. That is one great big dark hole of mystery, if you ask me, Michelle, because around 324 bodies have been recovered from the Thames in the past 12 years, especially in the months around Christmas and New Year.
Ooh.
And estimates say that along the full 213-mile course of the Thames, a dead body is washed up once a week on average.
Oh my God. So you're walking over the bridge to work and then you're just like, body.
I still live near the Thames. I used to live in Putney and I'd cross the bridge daily, and I did see on more than one occasion something that looks suspicious, like a person ready to jump.
Oh yeah, jumpers. Yes. I listened to a very interesting podcast about the Golden Gate Bridge and people about to jump.
Oh.
Might have to pin that.
That is interesting. I have heard about that as well. Yes.
It is really interesting.
We don't often hear about the bodies being washed up, but certain circumstances you will, such as the discovery in 2001 of the torso of a young African boy named Adam, because it was never discovered who he was actually. And he was thought to be the victim of a ritual killing. We have talked about this before in an early episode of the podcast. And warning, you will need a strong stomach for that one, because it was quite a rough ride. And then in 1989, of course, there was the Marchioness disaster, where 51 people died in the icy waters of the Thames while partying on a boat. That was purely an accident. Tragic.
Yeah.
There have been similar murders, though, on the Thames between 1873 and 1902. There was this thing known as the torso murders. They were also said to be linked to Jack the Ripper, but this is only speculation because the MO was different. It was dismemberment in these cases as opposed to genital abdominal mutilation
in Jack
the Ripper's case. Well, you know that's the case. And anyone worth their true crime salts knows that Jack the Ripper was all about genital abdominal mutilation and posing.
Chop here and a chop chop there. Terrible.
Michelle. It is terrible. Previously, it has taken about a year for a body to surface, and others sometimes get taken out to sea. So whether or not there's a serial killer on the loose targeting minorities or vulnerable people, I don't know. But I do feel deeply saddened by these people's young lives being cut short, and sympathise deeply with their families. Paul Conti's family have set up a petition calling on the police to investigate river deaths more thoroughly, which I think is definitely needed, and possibly more CCTV along there, improved lighting and increased patrols, which is what they're calling for.
Yep.
And it may help to avoid more tragedy in the future. Unless, Mary, the medium is right and we have a cross-dressing Rwandan genocidal priest on the rampage. But it does make you wonder how many secrets lie beneath the muddy Thames water. Perhaps, Michelle, I should stop swimming in it. What do you think?
I think you definitely should, because in recent years, since Brexit, the UK is now no longer beholden to the stringent water regulations of the EU, and the Thames is filthy. So get the fuck out of there.
Oh, God. Okay. That's an interesting thing to raise about the EU, because we did used to have blue flag beaches, but now I've got an app that tells me my favorite beaches and if they're safe to swim. And quite often there's effluent overflowing.
And that is why. Thank you, Brexit. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brexit.
And thank you for that story. That was really awful. But I do think for me, it does seem more like misadventure than a coordinated serial killer.
A lot of the time, yes. But sadly, there's some disgusting situations there. Like, for example, somebody's body being found before they've actually been reported missing. Weeks.
Yeah, that's tragic.
We got a bit bleak. We got a bit dumb. We're two birds yakking. Just having a laugh.
Well, thank you so much again. It's funny you talk about TikTok in your story, because there is a connection to TikTok in my story today.
Oh.
But this week, Geordie, we're getting into Jen's Datsun 180B.
Oh.
And we are heading back to August the 20th, 1989. My favorite decade.
I think I can tell you what was top of the pops then. Was it Smells Like Teen Spirit or something? No, that didn't come out then.
No, that was 91, 92. No, 89. I didn't do
89.
It.
Nothing compares. That'll be that one.
Fuck. We've talked about this on the podcast. Crying. I had to leave my ex-boyfriend in the train station, and we were singing Nothing Compares to Yours.
Nothing Compares to Yours.
Yes. Earlier podcast, check it out. But yes, we're going back to 1989, not to the UK, actually, to America, to a crime that rocked not only Beverly Hills, but the world. It's a crime where a rich Hollywood executive and his wife were murdered in their own mansion, and the killers turned out to be their sons.
Menendez.
Fucking right, it's Menendez.
Oh.
I was going to say, new generations don't know about the Menendez brothers, but they do. Pin that, because I'm going to go into that at the end of the episode here.
I thought you were going to say OJ, because it was around that
same
time.
Same time.
Well, OJ Simpson has just died, as we all know.
Didn't make a big blip, to be honest. It was a gentle...
because he didn't do any deathbed confessions, I think, is what people were after.
Menendez and OJ were around the same time. And actually, there is a theory that the OJ Simpson case did affect the Menendez brothers' case.
Really?
Yeah, in terms of OJ got off, the LAPD were so embarrassed by that they had to go hard on this case.
Right.
Yes. But if you don't know what we're talking about, I'll give you some background. August 20, 1989, two rich Beverly Hills brothers, Eric and Lyle Menendez, who were 18 and 21 at the time, spent the day swimming and playing tennis at their family's mansion in Beverly Hills. Then they went out shopping before going home to have dinner with their parents, Jose and Kitty, with plans to go to a movie afterwards. After dinner, the boys drove to a multiplex while Jose and Kitty decided to enjoy a nice little evening at home. Eventually, they decided to just kick back in the TV room, which had all of Eric and Lyle's tennis trophies, because these kids were tennis crazy. They were really good. And Jose and Kitty settled in to apparently watch a Bond movie on the telly.
Okay. Which one would that be? Live and Let Die. Octopussy.
Goldfinger.
Goldfinger.
A View to a Kill. A View to a Kill.
That was a bit earlier, I think. I'm just trying to think of the, what year are we again? 1989. It might have been, let's see. Oh, I don't know.
Well, it's on the telly, so it's an old one.
Oh.
It's not at cinema.
Could have been anything. Could have been Dr. No.
Could have been anything. Let's just say it was Octopussy, because it sounds so good to say. Octotravel Pussy. So that night at the Menendez home, the alarm system was turned off because the boys were always accidentally setting it off, and Kitty had enough.
Right.
So she just turned it off.
Okay.
And around 10 p.m., a neighbor heard firecrackers going off. Thought nothing of it. The boys got home after hanging out with friends at the Cheesecake Factory.
Oh, that sounds great. I'd love a Cheesecake Factory.
Just love a cheesecake right now. Mm. They were at the Cheesecake Factory until around 11:30. Well, actually, they got home at 11:30 to find their parents' bodies torn apart, ripped apart by bullets in the house.
Ripped apart?
Yep. Lyle called 911. You can find that recording all over the internet.
No thanks.
And when the police arrived, they found one of the brothers, don't know which one, in the fetal position on the lawn, just hysterically
sobbing.
Crying.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And initially, police thought this was a mafia hit because Jose was a Hollywood bigwig and had maybe done some dodgy business deals, and they thought maybe something had gone wrong. Mm. And in fact, Eric, one of the Menendez brothers, actually pointed the finger at a guy named Noel Bloom, who was a porn film distributor and supposedly a former part of the LA mafia underworld. These were brutal murders, Geordie. Mm. Jose suffered 5 shotgun blasts to the head and body, while Kitty was shot 9 times in the chest, right arm, left hip and left leg, and straight in the face.
Oh, my God. Why her in the face?
We'll get to that. It turns out the shell casings were removed from the scene. So police quickly ruled out murder-suicide. And because police could see how distraught the Menendez brothers were.
There was no way that they were suspects.
Yeah, they weren't suspects. And out of compassion to their hysterical sobbing, detectives that night just decided to skip giving the brothers the routine gunpowder residue tests on their hands that would have shown if either of them had fired a gun that night. Yeah. And to put this all in a little bit of context, these kids live in Beverly Hills. And at the time, 89, you were lucky to even have one murder a year in Beverly Hills. Yep. So they immediately assumed it must have been a breaking gone wrong or something.
Gangs from another area.
Yeah. So how could something like this happen to a nice, wealthy, middle class, well, not even middle class, upper class family in Beverly Hills?
Mm.
So Jose was a Cuban immigrant born in an upper middle class family in Havana in the 1940s. He was a pro level swimmer, had high aspirations as an athlete. So the family sent him to the US age 16 to escape Fidel Castro's regime. And at age 19, while studying at Southern Illinois University, he met Mary Anderson, nicknamed Kitty, who was a former blonde beauty queen. And pretty quickly, they had 2 kids. Joseph Lyle Menendez, he's going by his middle name, born January 10, 1968. And Eric Galen Menendez, born on November 27, 1971. And look, Jose quickly climbed up the corporate ladder. He was at Hertz Rent-A-Car. He then moved on to the record division at RCA, where he was the one that signed the Eurythmics, Duran Duran, and Menudo.
Who's that?
Do you know that band?
No. Sounds like a game.
It does sound like a game. And also Menudo. It just sounds weird.
Menudo.
Like nude. Anyway.
Menudo.
Menudo.
I'm Menudo. You're not Menudo.
It's a teenage Latino group with a revolving door of young boys. And it's how Ricky Martin got his start.
Oh.
He was in Menudo.
Menudo.
Eric and Lyle went to posh schools. They were training to become tennis pros.
Uh-huh.
And in 1986, Jose went for a promotion, didn't get it at RCA. So he left the company and moved the family to LA, where he got high-level roles at a company called International Video Entertainment. And as an executive there, Jose made big profits for the company because he was kind of an asshole businessman, you know. And according to reports I read, no one liked him. And he didn't have many friends. Mm. Kitty, in the meantime, was miserable in the marriage. She'd become an alcoholic. She was popping pills. Oh. She'd attempted to take her own life numerous times. And I had read that she'd wanted to become an actress. But when the kids were born, Jose, who was quite controlling apparently, was like, nope, you're a stay-at-home mum. Done. So it wasn't a happy family unit. The parents spoiled Lyle and Eric, but they were also very controlling and wanted them to be the best at everything and push them.
Yeah.
To the point where the parents would do the kids' homework for them.
Oh.
Which sounds great, except they were getting top marks in essays and they were dum-dums in the test. Because they didn't know anything. They hadn't learned shit. But they didn't want to be embarrassed and they wanted the boys to be like, achieve, achieve, achieve.
Pampered boys.
And they were pushed into doing tennis because the dad wanted this reflected glory of their sons being tennis pros. Eric even had dyslexia And the family hid it because they were ashamed of their defective kid. It's fucked.
Wow. That's a lot of pressure.
A lot of pressure. So when the family first moved to the West Coast, they lived in a place called Calabasas, which is totally like Kardashian country now, but not then. They were building this massive dream home when suddenly they just left it all, sold up and moved to Beverly Hills.
Oh.
Because it turns out Eric and Lyle were breaking into rich people's homes and stealing shit, stealing money, stealing jewelry to the tune of more than $100,000.
But they didn't need that.
Back in the 80s. No, they didn't. Basically, Jose stepped in, got the boys to give back all the stolen goods, wrote a check to the people they robbed, and then moved the fuck out of Calabasas.
Yeah.
Moved to Elm Drive. Not Elm Street. Okay. I wish it was.
Well, it was in the end. Nightmare on Elm Drive.
Really? Yeah. To a house, super rich mansion, where Elton John and Michael Jackson had previously both lived at various points.
God.
Not at the same time.
What are you saying?
I'm just saying, just making that clear, making a menudo here. Eric did take the rap for this, like, breaking into houses because he was younger and underage. And Lyle at this point was at Princeton. And he got into Princeton a little bit like that recent thing a couple of years ago. The dad donated $50,000. And he got in.
Yeah.
So in the end, Eric got probation. He made friends with some guy called Craig Signorelli. They were pretty tight, besties. And they ended up kind of encouraging each other to be kind of ostentatious assholes.
Mm.
Craig was gay. There were rumors that Eric was gay too. Together, they wrote this screenplay called Friends. Not the TV show. Friends didn't exist at that point. But they wrote this TV show called Friends.
Okay.
And the plot of this screenplay is basically a young guy who murders his rich parents for the inheritance. Kitty, the mum, even typed out the screenplay.
Oh.
Yeah. So Eric also had ideas that he wanted to be an actor or a model, but basically he was bullied into being a tennis star. He was just a rich kid. Meanwhile, Lyle got suspended from Princeton after he was caught cheating on a test. Basically worked at his dad's company for a bit where he was a spoiled dick and no one liked him. So he stopped doing that and they were doing nothing. They were just playing tennis all day. Jose was not loving this and threatened to cut both the boys out of his will, which freaked them out.
Oh.
Eric apparently was shy. While Lyle was a bit of a ladies' man who liked an older lady.
Older. Right.
I think there's nothing wrong with that, personally. Moving on.
Being an older lady.
And in 1989, I'm going to shush you. That's not nice. In 1989, Lyle moved to the guest house out the back of the big mansion while Eric stayed in the main house. And then, parents were brutally murdered. Eric and Lyle were listed as the sole beneficiaries of the Menendez estate, estimated at that point to be worth around $14 million. Oof. And immediately, both of them received $250,000 from a life insurance policy. You know, these kids are what, 18 and 21, did I say? Yeah. I can't remember. Living it up. They also stole Jose's American Express Platinum card. Living it up. Spending like bastards. They were just out there. After the murder, they didn't want to stay in the house. So they were just flipping from expensive hotel to expensive hotel. They rented some condos. You know, they were buying Rolexes. They were hiring fancy cars. One of them bought a restaurant. They were burning through the money. Turns out Elm Drive wasn't fully paid off.
Oh.
So that house was going to have to get sold. The company where Jose worked went into damage control after the murders. They arranged a memorial service for Jose where Eric and Lyle gave these heartfelt speeches, but they were really calm about what had happened to both their parents. Another funeral was held for Jose at Princeton, another one in Florida. The boys didn't even bother to show up to these. They were all funeraled out, I guess, and they were too busy spending it up. Also, they bought a Porsche, they bought Jeeps, they bought designer clothes, they were eating expensive dinners, Eric hired a personal tennis coach, they were zipping around on private jets, they were taking expensive ski holidays, they were buying the best tickets to like sports games, they were spending like crazy. But weirdly, considering how distraught they were on the night of their parents' murder, They didn't have a whole lot of interest in finding their parents' killer, apparently, according to the police. Now, apparently Jose's cousin Carlos did find a copy of the 1980 will of Jose in a bathroom drawer that stated that everything was going to go to the sons. But then he came across a different file on the family's computer labeled will, but he couldn't access it. And the kids, if you remember, had been told they were going to get cut out of the will. So they freaked out that Lyle found some computer expert who tried to like dodgy up the file. They couldn't open it and they wiped this computer except for something on a hard drive to make it look like it wasn't tampered with. It was all really weird. But clearly the kids thought there was a chance they were going to still be disinherited.
So had the will not been read at this point, they're spending.
They're spending because they stole the credit card and they got the $250K life insurance. Right. Later in 1989, a reporter called Robert Rand was tasked with writing about Jose. And Eric told him that his dad was driven and funny, but antisocial. And this is a quote. There were no times for him to get real close friendships and people became jealous of him. On the weekend, he wouldn't want to socialize. He would always stay home. Instead of going to the movies with my friends, I would just stay home with him. Hmm? We'd even take showers together.
What?
Lyle, me and my dad, we would just take showers together. We would do everything together.
What?
What the fuck? Pin that. Okay?
Okay.
In October, a couple of months after the murders, Eric contacted a psychologist he and the family had seen before called Dr. Jerome Ozil, saying he needed help. And Eric showed up at his office on the afternoon of October 31. Dr. Ozil shared a treatment room space with other doctors, including his wife, Laurel, who he had two kids with. So Eric was like, let's go for a walk. Apparently, somehow in the office, he did confess, I killed my mum and dad, to the psychologist. He said it had been eating him up. And apparently, Eric also kind of confessed to his friend, Craig, the one he did the screenplay with. So this kid, he's not good at keeping it inside.
Yeah.
Eric then called his brother Lyle and said, mate. He said, mate, obviously. He said, I've told the psychologist what we've done. And Lyle was fucking furious. Uh-oh. So he went straight over to Dr. Ozil's office and they both ended up confessing to Dr. Ozil that they'd killed their parents. Now, a woman in the waiting room called Judalon Smith. That's a fucking name.
Uh-huh.
She was in the waiting room. She apparently overheard the confessions.
What the? Fuck.
Turns out Judalon was Dr. Ozil's side piece.
What?
She confronted
this is crazy.
Dr. Ozil about what she'd heard and she was like, we got to go to the police, but they didn't. Also, besties Eric and Craig fell out because Eric thought Craig had talked to the police about what he'd kind of confessed to and it was true. Craig had gone to the police and on various occasions had been wearing a wire. So the brothers were on the police radar at this point.
Right. So did they get the confession on? No, they didn't get it on record.
No. But when Dr. Ozil gave Judalon the flick, she then went to the police and said, listen, these brothers confessed and you got to go over and sort this out. Eventually, March 8th, 1990, Lyle was arrested by a team of Beverly Hills cops. Eric was in Israel playing a tennis tournament. So he basically had found out his brother had been arrested. Oh. He called the police, told them he was flying in. They arrested him at LAX when he touched down. And both brothers were arrested and held in jail on suspicion of double murder. And they went and hired the best lawyers money could buy to get them off. The trial is what made these brothers famous.
Yes, exactly.
It all started December 1990 when Eric and Lyle were formally indicted. And apparently the brothers were laughing and smiling when they were read the charges that they were formally charged with first degree murder. They pleaded not guilty, but they were laughing and smiling. And this is what made people furious. Look, I did read somewhere that the reason they were laughing and smiling is because the judge had said Jose instead of Jose.
Right.
But it didn't matter. No one else saw that. All they saw were these two kind of preppy young kids, rich, spoiled kids laughing when they were charged with killing their parents. It didn't go down well. You know, the image of them being these spoiled rich kids with no remorse was done.
Yeah.
The trial actually began a few years later in 1993 in July. it was argued by the lead prosecutor against the brothers that the brothers committed the murders. It was premeditated. They did it to get the money.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the brother's lawyer argued self-defense due to years of physical,
right, here we go,
emotional,
sexual,
and sexual abuse, yep, by Jose and Kitty.
And Kitty, okay.
And that was the bombshell that came out at the trial.
Yeah.
Basically, sworn testimonies during the trial exposed Jose Menendez as kind of a Weinstein-style predator,
oh, no,
who was like mentally and sexually abusing his sons. If later allegations are to be believed, other boys too, including those kids from Menudo. And that has come out in later stories. So it's, oh, it's just really awful.
So is that confirmed?
There are Netflix documentaries and reports. There is a kid from Menudo who's come out and said he was sexually abused by Jose and another person from the record company.
Oh, that's awful.
Apparently, Jose wanted to mold Lyle into a little mini-me while Eric was kind of the spare, you know, heir and the spare. And there were lots of testimonies about what people saw Jose do to his kids. Relatives saw Jose punch Lyle in the chest when he was 5 years old after he misbehaved.
Oh, no. No.
And when this relative was like, "What are you doing?" He was like, "This is my house and I'll raise my kids any way I see fit." He's, wow, that kind of dad. And apparently too, Kitty was, I think, mentally and physically abused by Jose. She didn't, right, have much love for those boys, apparently. She resented, oh, them for kind of hijacking her career. Basically, at court, it was argued that Eric and Lyle were never good enough in the eyes of Jose. And that was like a lot of pressure, as you said before. Mm-hmm. But the most powerful testimonies during the trial came from Eric and Lyle. When they got, sure, up and talked about the mental abuse, the physical abuse, and the sexual abuse.
Trigger warning. Warning. Trigger warning.
Look out.
Trigger.
Oh my goodness. Warning. The chips. Brace yourself, Mavis.
Just hit skip for the next maybe 10, 20 seconds if you don't want to hear this.
Okay.
Lyle said things at the trial, like when he was six, Jose told him that what they were doing was a male bonding ritual like the Romans. And it started with Jose massaging his son after sports practice, and that some of the acts involved a toothbrush and a shaving utensil.
No, 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 no.
He then went on to say this went on until he was eight, and then it stopped because Jose began molesting Eric when he was six.
Oh,
and that never stopped. It went on for years and got more sadistic and brutal as time went on.
Oh, God.
So this was presented as an argument in court along with the events that led up to the murders. So Lyle and Kitty that night apparently got into a big fight about how the tennis was ruining their lives, and she got really angry and ripped the toupee off Lyle's head.
Toupee?
Apparently, Lyle as a kid wore a rug.
As a kid?
Yes. As a kid, he had some kind of condition. Eric never, oh, even knew about it. So that was humiliating. Then Jose told Eric he had to live at home instead of being on campus when he was starting, right, at UCLA soon. Then Eric confessed to Lyle that their dad had been sexually abusing him since, mm-hmm, the age of eight. And Lyle said he sort of maybe had an inkling about it. And so he confronted his dad when he was younger. But Jose told him that it was over and Eric was making things up. Now when he was hearing that Jose had lied and Eric had suffered abuse for years, it made him so full of rage that Lyle came up with this plan where, you know, he was going to confront his father, demand Eric go to Princeton, or he'd spill the beans and tell everyone that his dad was a sicko. You know, he did confront him. It did not go well. And Jose apparently said to Lyle, and this is a quote, "We all make choices in life. Eric made his and you've made yours."
What does that mean?
Well, I don't know, but Lyle took it to mean that his dad would do whatever it took to protect his good name.
Right.
I.e., they felt like their dad was going to kill them.
Was going to kill them. Right. Oh, God.
Yes.
Very different to the story I thought it was, Michelle.
Yeah, it's pretty dark. Kitty also confessed to the boys that she'd always known that Jose was abusing them and that she'd turned the other cheek. So they felt betrayed by her.
Oh, God.
There was also things that I had read that Kitty had also sexually abused the boys in the bathtub, oh, when they were younger. I mean, I just don't know what to believe about this case. But either way, it's fucked, yeah, up. So on Friday, August 18, Eric and Lyle drove to San Diego. I think I said that this fight happened on the night of the murder. It didn't.
Okay.
It happened a couple of days before the murder because on Friday, August 18, Eric and Lyle drove to San Diego, bought two shotguns, hid them in Eric's bedroom. When they got home on Saturday, August 19, they really believed their lives were in danger and that Jose and Kitty were plotting to kill them, but they were pretending like nothing was going on. They made plans for a fishing trip. They thought they were going to get murdered on the boat.
Wow.
They went on the fishing trip. It was horrible. They weren't killed, but they were really nervous. Yeah. The boys were nervous. They were like, when's it going to happen? When's it going to happen? And then it turned into, we need to kill them before they kill us. Mm. So on the night of the murders, Eric got home around 9:30. Jose demanded that Eric go upstairs and wait for him.
Oh.
That apparently was code for his dad wanting to have sex with him.
Oh, no.
So Eric was like freaking out. Then Jose was like, go upstairs and wait for me.
Jesus.
He then pulled Kitty into the TV room, shut the doors. The brothers believed this was a signal that they were about to be killed. And they were like, it's got to be now. Right. We've got to kill them now. They loaded up their guns. They went into the living room, shot their parents to pieces.
Oh my God.
Then they waited for the police to show up, but nobody came. They thought it was fireworks.
No.
So then the boys were like, fuck, we've got to try and cover this up. So they took all the shells, tried to create an alibi, went to the movies, tried to get a timestamp on the ticket, but it didn't work. So they drove around. Finally, Lyle called 911. They went back to the house. You know, it's all a fuck up.
Wow.
Essentially, Eric and Lyle were claiming self-defense, but the jury didn't buy it. They thought they were acting. They said it was crocodile tears. They didn't like the attitudes. They were rich kids in pastel jumpers and chinos and buffy hair and smirks on their faces. So even though the harrowing accounts of child abuse and sexual abuse seemed to really ring true, no one believed they just snapped and killed their dad. They just thought these kids want the money.
Yeah.
Even though the defense did present weird naked pictures of Eric and Lyle when they were 6 and 8 years old.
Oh, God.
Yep, in the case. So these kids, I really do believe they were abused, but the jury were not having any of it. So finally, on December 3rd, 1993, the jury was deadlocked, a mistrial was declared. And obviously this was headline news all over the world. It was reality TV before reality TV existed. Yeah. The boys were celebrities. It was Menendez mania. The press were there. TV crews were there. It was a media circus. And they got off the murder charge and it made news all around the world. Yes, people were outraged. So there was a second trial. The Menendez brothers at this point were broke. They'd spent all their money on the lawyers for the first trial. So they had to have state lawyers. And this time, no TV crews allowed. The boys were tried separately, not as brothers. The judge was a hard ass. OJ had been let off and they were going hard.
Yeah.
In 1996, the jury found Eric and Lyle guilty of murder in the first degree and they were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole ever. And they were taken away to separate prisons for life. And they're still behind bars today. But things have taken a twist in this case.
Thanks to TikTok.
Yes.
Oh.
So in 2018, a letter from Eric to his cousin was found from December 1988, where it basically confirmed the sexual abuse had been going on for a long time. So Eric's lawyers are trying to get this to qualify as new evidence so there can be a new investigation into the case. Plus, like I said before, there have been allegations of sexual abuse by Jose with a number of boys in Menudo. And allegations that Jose would drug them and then rape them.
Oh,
it's
God.
It's just fucked up. And like we mentioned earlier, the Menendez brothers have become stars on TikTok and they've become Gen Z heroes. So there's this whole generation who are like, who are these hotties from the 90s who are in prison? God. There are loads of memes about these boys who got fucked over by the system. And this is the perspective of kids who have grown up with Me Too, seeing the fallout from Epstein's Island. You know, they have taken the Menendez brothers on as victims of the system. And all this renewed interest has led to a petition. And it was filed in May 2023.
Oh my gosh.
It was requesting that the court look at the case again. Plus, obviously, they've got the letter and the Menudo stuff that's come out. And it could mean that after 30 years in prison for the double murder of their parents, Gen Z and TikTok could have an impact on the Menendez case. And it could see the brothers released. Wow. So stay tuned. That's all I got for you.
That's a mind boggler, Michelle. What a lot of info you've given me just now and the listeners. I had no idea. I mean, I was aware of the Menendez brothers, of course. I was around when it was going on, but not interested. I was living my life, you know. But wow, that's insane and horrifying and very, very upsetting.
It's so tragic, but a little bit like the Free Britney movement, these kids are getting shit done with TikTok. You know, it's amazing.
Whether or not it's the right thing to do, I just don't know.
I mean, look, the Menendez brothers, they are both been married. One of them still married. The other one.
In jail.
In jail. Yeah. Yeah. They met some girls, you know, like you've got these women who write to people in jail. Well, he married one, but he cheated on her. So she divorced him and now he's married to another one. Like, you know, it's a soap opera.
How do you cheat in jail?
I guess conjugal visits.
Okay.
I guess she came in and God knows, but it's a really fascinating case and it's not over. I think this is going to run.
Conjugal visits, let me just say something. I don't think that you're just allowed to randomly turn up and say, I demand a conjugal visit with this person.
I want to shag him.
Unless it's the wife, you wouldn't get the conjugal visit. So how could he cheat? This is the thing. It must be intellectually cheating, emotionally cheating. Mm. Exactly.
Well, I did not look into that.
My God, Michelle, what a lot. What a lot. Oh, no, that's not the point to focus on, is it? The conjugal visit. That's incredible. Listen, I'd love to hear what listeners think about this. It was a rough ride this episode. Apologies. But yes, what do you think? Did we handle it sensitively? Was it interesting to you? Are you intrigued by either of the stories that we've talked about today? I'd love to know. Also, we did get a little something, and I'm going to end on a sweet note, from Safka, who had confessed the week before about her pacemaker and her near-death experience. Now, such a lot of respect for Safka sharing that message with us. She's also said that she's watching a great TV show at the moment.
Okay.
And thanks to you, Safka, I am going to settle down tonight and I'm going to watch on Netflix Ripley, starring Andrew Scott, who was the hot priest in Fleabag. I'm going to do that because I've been watching Three Body Problem, which is by the people who make Game of Thrones, and I'm finding it very amateur. I'm finding it really wooden scripts, really bad scripts, really, really shit acting, and a very flimsy story.
Okay, you got to move
Even
on.
Even though I am interested to know where it's going to go, but I'm going to have to ditch it, yeah.
Well, let me know how that telly rep goes.
That's TV for you.
Yes. And Geordie, I think we've come to that point where there's only three things left to say.
That's wherever you are.
Whatever you do, just keep eavesdropping.
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 Dropping.
Eavesdropping. Dropping. Eavesdropping.
Dropping.
Eavesdropping.